Everybody ready?
Oh, sure.
Good afternoon. Sorry. Vice Chair Telfer, I did not mean to reach your eardrum there. Good afternoon, and I will call the Wednesday, February 18th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development to order. And I will mention my announcement that people should turn off their cell phones. They're, as my dad would say, strawberries, iPhones, or whatever such devices you may have with you, because they do interfere with our very sensitive recording devices. So, members, we have two bills to hear public testimony on today, so I will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 4622.
4622 or 462?
462.
Okay. I was going to say it was a new numbering system if I heard that correctly, but apparently I didn't. That must have been that gavel.
You missed it. Yeah, I didn't hear it either. You missed a few thousand bills. Legislative Council, I hope they're not listening to me. Okay, so we're on Senate Bill 462, and Mr. Committee Administrator, briefly tell us what this bill does.
Madam Chair and committee members, this relates to unemployment insurance benefits. And the bill creates an alternative base year, which comprises the last four completed calendar quarters preceding the benefit year for purposes of determining eligibility for unemployment insurance benefits. And our witnesses will explain exactly how that works. We have a finding of no revenue impact, and we do not yet have the fiscal statement on the bill.
Thank you for that explanation. And I will first call forward from the Employment Department, Lori Warner and Tom Byerly and Susan Johnson, if the three of you would please come forward. Good afternoon, and
good afternoon.
Welcome back to the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Director of the Employment Department. With me is Tom Byerly, the Unemployment Insurance Division Administrator, and Susan Johnson, the Benefits Manager. We're here to talk with you about Senate Bill 462, Alternative Base Period, and 463, Part-Time Worker Coverage for UI Benefits. Before I get into a few remarks, I wanted to mention to you that you have a copy of a letter from the Chair, Linda Rasmussen, of our Advisory Council in front of you somewhere, I believe. And if I might, can I read this so that you know she was not able to be here today but wanted to be on the record in terms of the Advisory Council action related to these bills?
Yes, I would appreciate it if you would do that. And members, you do have some materials that were delivered to your office and also are in front of you, and that includes this letter, I believe, that Director Warner is about to read into the record.
Okay, this is, Dear Senator Rosenbaum, as Chair of the Oregon Employment Department Advisory Council, I'm writing to express support of the three pieces of legislation that are or will be before the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee, Senate Bill 461, Senate Bill 462, and Senate Bill 463. On February 12, 2009, the Advisory Council voted to support these bills, UI worker training, alternative base period, and part-time worker coverage. It is especially important to get Senate Bill 462, alternative base period passed quickly in order for Oregon to access $90 million in funding provided for in the very recent federal stimulus package. These funds currently reside in a federal unemployment account and cannot be accessed fully without having an alternative base period language in state statute. If you have any questions regarding this letter of support, please do not hesitate to contact me. Sincerely, Linda Rasmussen, Chair, Oregon Employment Department Advisory Council. So with that, you will recall that adoption of an alternative base period, which is the 462 before you, for UI benefit determination is required for states to access the $70 billion in incentive funds for UI modernization. And if adopted, Oregon would receive $90 million.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Senator Przanski, please go ahead.
And if we don't adopt it, we're not eligible, correct?
That is correct.
Madam Chair, I've got a motion for the committee.
Unfortunately, Senator Przanski, we did not host this bill for a work session.
Oh, God.
I want to mention to you that Senate Bill 463 is not required to receive the UI modernization funds, but is a policy question before the legislature for you to to act upon. With that, Tom Byerly and Susan Johnson will talk about the specifics of Senate Bill 462 and how that would work if it was adopted by the legislature.
Thank you for your testimony, and I think we'll hear from all three of these witnesses before we open it up for questions. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Byerly, Administrator for the Employment Trust Division for the Employment Department. Just want to mention or give a little background that since the UI program, the Employment Trust program, was implemented in Oregon as a result of the Social Security Act, we actually started here in 1937. We pretty much had the same base year for unemployment insurance claim filings that whole time, so 70-plus years. Since then, as you might have gathered, the workforce has changed, the way we do business has changed, and it's probably time to maybe do a little bit of a modernization to the way we figure unemployment insurance claims. Currently, the system in Oregon has a significant barrier to obtaining benefits for some workers that are maybe on the lower end of the wage scale or maybe part-time and don't have a complete work history yet. What Senate Bill 462 attempts to do is change that base period so we can reach more claimants, and I was going to let Susan Johnson explain the mechanics of the bill.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and committee members. So Senate Bill 462 amends...
And if you could please identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Susan Johnson. I'm the Benefits Manager for the Oregon Employment Department. So Senate Bill 462 amends ORS 657-150 to provide an alternate base year for unemployment insurance benefits. As Lori Warner indicated earlier, that does mean $90 million to us. Unemployment insurance benefits, or the weekly benefit amount, is based on the first four out of the last five completed quarters. That means that we always have a lag quarter. So if you were to file a claim today, we would bypass the fourth quarter of 2008 and go back and use the prior four quarters. Approximately 8% of all folks who file unemployment insurance claims are non-valid due to a shortage of hours or wages. Approximately 6,000 of those claims will be valid if we use the last four quarters. The work for our staff comes into play during the first weeks of a quarter in which someone tries to file a claim. As Tom Byerly indicated, unemployment insurance has been around since 1935 for Oregon, 1937, and not much has changed in the state of Oregon. Employers are required to, we have modernized a little bit, but employers are required to report wages the last day of the first month following the quarter in after the quarter ends. I'm not sure if I said that right. So if the quarter ends December of 2008, employers would have to have their quarterly report in January 31st, or if that's a Saturday, the next working day. So 44% of all employers file electronically, and 54% of all employers are still filing by paper. However, a lot of the larger employers are actually filing electronically, so 70% of all employees' wages are in our system within the first 5 weeks of a claim. The rest come in a couple weeks later. This means a manual process for staff until those wages are in our system, thus the fiscal, which you'll be receiving a little later. This will also require that we have some staff training. It'll require that we make some adjustments to our computer system. It'll make all of our publications probably will need to be revised. Not all of them, but probably 70% of our publications will need to be revised. I think that's all I have. Do you have any questions?
Okay, members, are there any questions for the department? Yes, Senator Telfer.
On the revision of the forms, you send out new forms annually anyway, right?
For employers.
Right.
We do, yes. But we also have a variety of other publications. We have claimant handbooks.
Right.
We have tons of publications. We have an employer handbook, and not all of those are actually revised annually. They're revised as needed.
Okay.
Other questions for the department? I guess I would have a question, and perhaps maybe for Mr. Byerly. So how would an applicant for benefits actually experience this change when it takes effect?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. Thank you for that. What we would envision is one of two things. Right now, unemployed Oregonians can file via the Internet or over the phone through one of our call centers. And at either method, They would get a real-time estimate of their benefit eligibility or their entitlement, if you will. If it turns out when we look at the regular base period, they don't have enough wages or hours to qualify, we would then say, huh, there's not enough there. What have you done the last 3 months? So if that's not in our system, we would ask them for some sort of a number or days of work from that employer that we could then contact that employer and have those wages brought in. By the same token, on the internet side, we would have a questionnaire that would, whenever something comes up, we can bring a pop dialog box that pop down that could fill out some more information so we could go after those wages manually. So we would always ask if there were subsequent wages that we weren't seeing whenever a claim came up non-valid.
Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
I think based on what we hear, the programs probably need to get a few things on the record, if we could, Tom and maybe Susie. Understand that $90 million is what we would receive. This is a stimulus. What happens once that money's gone? I mean, what is that? I mean, we'll change our system, so I'm going to ask a couple different questions. So this is an incentive to go in to make this change, and what?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, the money would go into the trust fund after we applied for, after we demonstrated to the U.S. Department of Labor we had this provision in our law. So we would have $90 million. And the additional benefits, the additional claims paid out, the 6,000 claims per year, would draw down that $90 million. And eventually, there could be a small impact to the trust fund. We're estimating around $8 million per year would be the drawdown on the trust fund. So eventually, we would run out of money, and the trust fund would automatically take up that slack.
All right, so we're looking at somewhere in the range of having a payout for like 5 years, maybe a little bit more as to if it mm-hmm. buys down 800.
That, Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, that would depend on if this was the only bill that was passed or there were other bills passed, like the part-time or training or other bills that would also draw down the trust fund. So if this standing alone, I think we were saying around 5 years. Lori, correct me if I'm wrong.
About 5 to 8 years.
Yeah. Okay.
If you only adopt alternative base period. But you are correct. This is one-time incentive money. And so the cost of this long-term will be just part of the trust fund calculation.
Okay, and then follow up, if I could.
Yes, please.
I think two questions with that is the impact on the agency itself in the sense of how many FTE or individuals will it take to implement and carry out the program, and I guess, and then just the actual cost. I'm assuming that's been factored in at some point, but would that be offset from that $90 million, or are we talking about needing authorization through Ways and Means process, or what?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, the fiscal impact for this is we submitted to Legislative Fiscal Office, and yes, there is about 34 FTE involved with doing alternative base period as we have currently calculated it, and so we will need authority from Ways and Means for the FTE as well as the administrative costs to process these. The administrative cost, there is also a part of the $90 million. There's $5 million of that that's coming to states for administrative costs related to transitioning your IT system and hiring and training additional staff and those kinds of things. And there is a federal reimbursement formula for how many claims you process every year where you are reimbursed regularly for administration. Albeit, a lot of times, it doesn't fully cover the cost of the administrative side of this. So.
All right.
So I think, yes, Senator George, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It brings up an interesting question is that would we still qualify for the federal money if we put an 8-year sunset on it to reevaluate the program about the time that the fund is projected to start running in the negative?
I can take a stab at answering that question, and then you can correct me if I'm wrong. As currently drafted, this bill actually adopts this provision contingent on receipt of these federal funds. It doesn't make it a permanent part of Oregon law. So I think, as currently drafted, the legislature would actually have to then incorporate this as a permanent change to our definition of base year. But
Madam Chair, Senator George, that is correct. The money would be contingent on this being a permanent change. The drivers behind and the sponsors of this bill at the congressional level want this to be a permanent, quote, modernization of the unemployment insurance system.
So I think just to sort of further the discussion, the money that would be forthcoming that has already been now signed into law by the president as of yesterday would only be available to states that have adopted an alternative base year provision, which many states, I believe something like 21 or 20 states already have. So states like Oregon, to be eligible for any of this money, need to change their law in this respect. And then I think what the department is telling us is of the money that would flow to the states, there's a segregated amount for administrative expenses.
That's correct.
That's correct. But this would be a permanent change to how Oregon calculates eligibility for UI benefits.
Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. To justify the 34 FTE, tell me, my impression on the surface is that we're basically adding 3 months of into the calculation. I mean, it's a timing difference, meaning we're just picking up 3 months, the most recent quarter. Why 34 FTE required to do this? And then, some one-time updating of certain documents that are printed, informational.
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Telfer, staff have to manually request those wages. So if a claimant were to file a claim that's non-valid, staff need to send the employer a document to what we call it a calendar letter. So we would have to send that to the employer. We'd have to put this in a tickler file to follow up on it. It'd be an electronic system. But we'd have to capture that information from the employer, who would have to manually data enter this into our computer system. So you've got work on the claims taker's side to, you know, to question the claimant and to send out the document. And then you have work on, it would require some tax work. It would go to our tax section to oftentimes audit or send out a form to perhaps, audit's not the correct word, but to inquire about the earnings and so forth. There's a little bit of work from an administrative law judge in the event that someone appeals that finding. A little clerical work, just a variety of work throughout the agency.
A follow-up question,
yes, please.
The other 20 states that are doing this, have they some sort of, are they all doing this manually too? I mean, 34 FTE seems like a lot to basically just bring in 3 more months into the unemployment.
Right.
Calculation.
Yeah, Vice Chair Temple. States do it differently. There is one state that simply waits for the employers to send the reports in. So it could be, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks while someone's sitting without an unemployment check. So states do this differently. It is costly. it is definitely costly. But, Tom, you may have more information.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Telfer, if I may, one of the things that the federal government requires us to do is to meet a timely first payment level of performance, if you will, and it's around 93% of all the claims that were filed. We need to pay within the first 21 days. So that's very important to Oregon, and in the recessions, we've always stayed above that first pay time lapse. That gets money back into the people's pockets and into the communities. We would want to strive to maintain that even when we were looking at an additional, as Susan mentioned, 17,000 claimants to pay 6,000 more. So I know it seems like a lot of staff, but it takes a lot of staff to run those wages down and to process it and write decisions and get the correct calculations done.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions for the department? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, and please stand by in case we need you again. Next, I'll call Joy Markheim and Christina Martin. And I believe Pam already handed out the testimony that you're about to present, Joy, so you must have given it to
the committee assistant.
Yeah. So members, I think you have that.
Yep.
Was given to you along with the department's testimony. Please go ahead.
Hi, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Thank you very much for letting me speak to you today. My name is Joy Markheim. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy in Silverton, Oregon. We're a nonprofit research organization that focuses on budget, tax, and economic policy with a goal of improving decision-making and expanding opportunities for all Oregonians. And you'll see that my written testimony addresses both of the bills you're hearing today, but I've submitted two copies, so you do have one for each bill file. I'm here right now to speak in support of SB 462, which will allow more workers, and particularly low-wage workers, access to unemployment insurance benefits. Now, the Oregon Center for Public Policy biannually puts out a report on Oregon's economy, and our most recent version of that report, which came out recently, is called Rolling Up Our Sleeves. And in that report, we explain how currently the unemployment insurance system excludes many low-wage workers. Nationally, low-wage workers are about half as likely as higher-wage workers to get unemployment benefits. And this is true even though they're twice as likely to be unemployed. So they're more likely to be unemployed, less likely to collect benefits. SB 462 would take important steps to modernize Oregon's unemployment insurance system in order to cover more workers. And there's a financial incentive, as has been mentioned already to this committee, for Oregon to modernize its unemployment system. That's the federal government is providing funding as part of the stimulus package that can be used to implement these bills. As the Employment Department staff have already explained to you, SB 462 would allow workers to count more of their recent work history when they're calculating unemployment eligibility. So under the alternative method, laid-off workers would still have to meet the standards for wage and hours that any other worker would have to meet for eligibility, but they wouldn't have to exclude up to 6 months of their most recent work history, which is something that happens under the current system. This helps workers who work intermittently or who have recently returned to work, for example, after a period of schooling or caretaking. Most of the workers who need alternative base period in order to qualify for unemployment benefits are low-wage workers. And you'll see that I submitted with my testimony a fact sheet that OCPP put out today on SB 462, and it includes a chart that explains how alternative base period works that we thought that you might find useful.
And members, this is actually, your testimony is paper-clipped together, but if you look at the last page, which is a standalone page that says fact sheet February 18th and then has SB 462, if you flip it over on the back, there is really the best pictorial demonstration that I have seen of how this alternative base period actually lays out in terms of a calendar year. So please go ahead, Joy.
Question?
Yeah.
If a person is works part-time and then decides to go to school, goes to school, is then eligible, and then just tell me how a student is able to qualify for unemployment then.
I'm sorry, I might have confused you. I was speaking of somebody who had been a student, entered the workforce, worked for about 6 months, and then got laid off. And they would currently have,
yes,
or not be able to qualify because they'd have to exclude so much work.
Thank you.
So there are sound reasons to enact SB 462, and not the least of which is the financial incentive. As has been explained, Oregon will qualify for its full share of federal funding under the stimulus bill if it enacts an alternative base period, as in SB 462. In addition, the fact that 20 other states have successfully implemented this provision indicates that it should be feasible to implement. So, therefore, by extending unemployment benefits to thousands of workers, SB 462 both helps struggling workers and their families, and it will help to stabilize the economy. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Joy? Okay, thank you. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Christina Martin. I'm from the Cascade Policy Institute. And actually, I'm here to support this particular bill. I think that if you accept the premise of our current system, our current unemployment system, as it is, then this really makes sense. I think this bill makes sense, and actually the part-time, the next bill you'll be hearing, I think also makes sense. But I think that there are also some serious issues that the current system has that should be looked at, and namely, it's been shown that unemployment insurance actually increases the unemployment rate. And I think that there are ways to address those issues, and I think that it would behoove the legislature to perhaps look into getting a task force or looking at ways to fix these other issues. And also, if this is going to, at some point in time, tax the trust fund and cause tax rates to go up, I think it would also, I think it would be a bad idea to have those tax rates increase, because ultimately, it's actually the employee who pays. Although employers pay the payroll tax, studies have shown that the cost actually comes out of the employee's pocket unless unless employers are paying a higher rate because of experience rating. So ultimately we approve of this, but I would encourage you to look into other ways to improve the system.
Questions for this witness? Yes,
well,
Vice Chair Telfer.
Question for clarification. As an employer, owner of five different companies, how is the unemployment insurance premiums that an employer pays out of the pocket of the employee?
Well, if you take a basic example, for example, let's just say I'm getting paid. I'm not going to tell you how much I'm getting paid because that's awkward, but let's just say I'm getting paid like $10,000, okay? The cost to the employer to employ me is more than $10,000. So, for example, you pay an additional what is the current, well, I don't know your experience rating for your particular business, but let's say it's 2.4% for the first $30,000 of wages, so it'd be 2.4% on my $10,000. So you're paying more money to employ me, and studies have shown that that actually, employers want to pay their employees lots of money so that they can attract better workers, and because I'm sorry, I'm not explaining this very well, but ultimately, it comes out of the pocket of the employee because the employer cannot pay the employee as much anymore.
Are you done?
Well, I was just going to say, unless the employer has a really bad experience rating, does everyone know what an experience rating is? Okay, you all do. Okay, I won't tell you then. So if they have a higher experience rating because they've laid off many employees, then that percentage above the standard base rate for payroll taxes, that part comes out of the employer's pocket. That's what studies have shown.
I'd be interesting seeing the studies follow up because I think one of the other questions I have would be, given the fact that wages are subject to vast amount of payroll taxes, it is somewhat of an incentive to provide the employee with non-taxable benefits, such as health insurance. And so there's some incentives to put money back into an employee's pocket tax-free, so they may balance each other out. So
I could send you a copy of
that. That would be great. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you would provide that to the committee administrator so that it could be shared with other committee members, that would be great as well.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you both for your testimony. And it looks like we have two more people signed up, and they are Sybil Hebb and Steve Lanning. Please come forward.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead. Gentleman first.
Well, she said go first, so I'm going
to. I saw it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO.
being from the state's largest labor organization, we just want to go on record in supporting Senate Bill 462. We think it's a great idea. You know, it'll bring 6,000 more folks, jobless folks, into the system, and it's got to help the economy as well. Federal funds definitely make it a very positive thing as well. We just want to get on the record. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Sybil, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I just wanted to follow up on a point that I think was made earlier, but echo that from the perspective of providing services to low-income Oregonians across the state. I think many people make an assumption that people were living at the federal poverty level are not employed, and that's not the case. A significant number of our clients are, in fact, employed, some of them part-time and some of them full-time, and for those people really living at the very edge, they're often one paycheck away from missing a house payment, missing a rent payment, missing a car payment. And so for those vulnerable clients, the ability to have quick and easy processing of unemployment claims as well as greater access for part-time workers is really essential and important. So we really appreciate the committee's support for consideration of the bills. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you both. Senator Przanski?
When we're finished with anyone coming, I was going to ask if Tom could come back up. I just wanted to follow up when we get to that point.
Sure. I think that point would be now.
Great.
And I wanted to mention, committee members, there's also written testimony from the Northwest Workers' Justice Project, which was in front of you at your places on this bill as well. So please place that in your files. And Senator Przanski, please go ahead.
Thank you. Tom, thanks for coming back up. Looking at the stuff that OCPP sent out or gave to us on the end notes, it talks about the 20 different states that have had adopted this to some level. I understand some are, one of them is partial, looks like Minnesota. Has the agency been able to do any, let's say, cross-reference checking with any of the states to see what their experience has been and how it's actually played out? I mean, because one of the conditions I heard was, depending on how many more bills we might pass or whatever else may impact how these funds are going to be expended down and stuff like that. So I'm just wondering if we have any track records to put on the record.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, for the record again, Tom Byerly, Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division, Employment Department. That's a great question, and Susan and I both meet regularly with our counterparts. I say regularly, at least once a year. And I'm on a National Unemployment Insurance Committee with one of our associations. We meet quarterly. And so we do exchange notes, and we do compare how things are going in other states. And this probably is no surprise to you, Senator, but I think we do it right here in Oregon and better than the other states. And pardon me, I think we got a pretty good handle on where we need to go to do this as streamlined as possible. And I actually think we're going to do it better than other states. I don't know if that answers your question. It's probably just a lot of hot air.
Very honest.
Yes, I've rarely heard anybody say that in front of a committee. So, yes, Senator George, please go ahead.
Just so I understand this, $90 million that's being offered, how many bills do we have to pass to get that $90 million? Because here's what I'm really concerned about, basically following up with what the Senator said. I mean, if you start opening up enough of these things, if you lost the money, and I mean, if you could burn through this money, especially in this environment, in 2 or 3 years, if we burn through $90 million in 2 or 3, you know, maybe 2 biennium, you're talking $45 million more on businesses every biennium for who knows into the future because we took this $90 million up front. That's a very concerning issue. So if you could, how many bills do we have to do, and what is the impact of all those bills, and can we just adopt one and still get the money?
Madam Chair, Senator George, this is the only bill we have to adopt to get the federal incentive money. This is the only one. And as I stated earlier, this one we estimate a drain on the trust fund of about $8 million per year based on our 6,000 additional claim estimate. Now, as we add other bills, that number would obviously go up. But to back to your question, we don't have to pass anything but this bill to get that money. We could, I hope this doesn't sound too much like I'm offering an opinion because it's really not my decision, it's yours, but we could just adopt this one bill and save that $90 million in the trust fund to help offset these costs for years to come. However, there are other policy discussions on the table that could impact that $90 million going forward. We don't have we don't have an actual calculation how it would impact the trust fund going forward. Yet there are some calculations coming out, I guess, this Friday, some unemployment numbers coming out next Monday. So it's really tough to say what the trust fund is going to look like going forward.
Thank you very much.
And I guess that the other thing that, and we can actually provide this to committee members again, we did have testimony from the department at their informational overview that outlined what the requirements of this federal legislation are, and the fact that there were other provisions in addition to this one, which is a mandatory one for all states to be eligible for this fund. There are other provisions which are sort of a menu of options to be adopted. Oregon does not have all of the others, but it does have some of the others already in law. So I think that, Senator George, is probably the answer to what you were asking. And we can actually, I think, get that testimony again. And that actually was laid out pretty clearly hearing.
Once you have an alternate base period, you pass muster with the stimulus package. And technically, you would get the first third of your allotment. And your state's allotment is based on the percentage of your Federal Unemployment Tax Act receipts from your state. We're about 1.3% of the whole United States in Federal Unemployment Tax Act receipts. So that's how we arrived at that estimated number. So, but then after the first third, there's a menu, as Chair Rosenbaum said, of four other provisions that you could have, and you need to have two out of the four. We have two out of those four. And so we're in good position on those other ones. So we then would qualify for the second two-thirds just by passing this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 462? Good afternoon. Welcome to the Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Alan Tressiter, and I represent the Northwest Grocers Association. I actually hadn't planned to testify today, but testimony has sort of compelled me to say a few things and ask a few questions. Our concern is not with Senate Bill 462. I mean, I think getting $90 million in federal money for the unemployment trust is something that you probably ought to take advantage of. Our concern lies in the aggregate of bills that you have before this committee. While we heard testimony that 462, that if you just pass 462, I think that the trust would last 8 to 10 years. You're going to hear Senate Bill 463 next. That I believe would expedite the drawdown on the trust fund fairly rapidly if you include part-time employees. And one of the people testifying said that employers want to give increased benefits to their employees, and that is absolutely true. In the grocery business, we're in a very competitive business. Over half our workers are union members. But there is a difference between wanting to enhance benefits and having the ability to enhance benefits, particularly in this economy today. So I'd just caution you that accepting the $90 million and then passing a series of bills that have the effect of chewing through that $90 million fairly rapidly leaves businesses then at the end of that time period, whether that's 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years from now, with an expectation and a statute that requires us to cover part-time employees and others, and the $90 million's gone. And so then you come and increase unemployment insurance rates. And we would be cautious against you doing that sort of thing. This is, I believe that we are in, I'm not the only one. I mean, we're in the midst of a global depression, okay? It's not going to go away overnight. We are all doing everything we can possibly do to keep as many people as employed as possible at living wage rates. So I would just ask you to not pass legislation that has the effect of increasing cost to business within the next foreseeable future. So that's my testimony.
So I'm interpreting that as testimony on both of these bills. Is that what you're offering?
That would be it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony.
And is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 462? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 462 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 463. And I think the department, if you want to come back up and offer some additional comments, please come forward. And before you identify yourselves again, I should let our administrator explain this bill.
Madam Chair, this bill relates to unemployment benefits for people who have a history of part-time work. It expands the availability of unemployment benefits to an otherwise qualified person seeking only part-time work where the person has qualified for benefits based on part-time work. And we have no revenue impact, and we are awaiting a fiscal statement.
And could you tell us what documents might be in our file that were...
In your file, you have a letter from the Northwest Workers Justice Project. You should have a fact sheet from Oregon Center for Public Policy. You have a copy of a letter from the chair of the advisory committee, the Oregon Employment Department Advisory Committee, and you have the one-page description from the Oregon Employment Department. That's just been handed out.
Great. Okay. Please go ahead. Welcome back. And you will need to re-identify yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Byerly, Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. excuse me. Thank you for allowing us to offer some more testimony. As I indicated on Senate Bill 462, the unemployment insurance system in Oregon has remained pretty much static since its inception in 1937. And since that time, we believe the nature of the workforce, as I've indicated, and the economy has really changed. And there's now a more reliance on part-time, intermittent jobs and workers. And more employers are hiring part-time workers and spreading the work over a larger pool of employees. And even as baby boomers are retiring, they're finding that, you know what, they need to go back to work part-time. And they are still very much attached to the labor force. And however, if they become unemployed through no fault of their own, right now there's no way to reach them. So that's just a little bit of background of what's behind the part-time worker bill in Senate Bill 463, and I'll let Susan Johnson describe the mechanics of the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Susan Johnson. I'm the manager of the Unemployment Insurance Benefits Program for the Employment Department. Senate Bill 463 amends ORS 657-155. This proposal would allow people who previously worked part-time and who meet all other eligibility requirements to receive unemployment insurance benefits if they're seeking part-time work. Currently, unemployment insurance claimants are required to actively seek and be available for part-time, temporary, and full-time work in order to be eligible for benefits. So this bill would allow those people who have qualified monetarily for a claim based on their part-time work to be eligible for part-time benefits. We estimate approximately 7,000 part-time workers would qualify for benefits under this provision. 20 other states currently have a part-time provision. And this bill would update Oregon unemployment insurance law to allow workers seeking part-time to receive benefits. Pretty simple. Do you have any questions?
So I do actually have a question, and I think it's probably for Lori or Tom. The thing that does seem perplexing to me is that employers are paying unemployment insurance taxes on people's wages who are working part-time, and then when these people lose their jobs and meet all the other qualifications, they are disqualified from collecting benefits, and it doesn't seem it doesn't seem like it computes economically to, on the one hand, require taxes to be paid on these wages, which we have to do, and on the other hand, to just, by definition, say this whole category of people can never collect benefits. So what's the answer to that one? Madam Chair, I think that's the policy question before all of you, because as the director of the department, I get many letters from folks that have been working part-time and are denied benefits under the system because they want to seek part-time work. They don't want to work full-time. They have family obligations around some of the other hours, or they're going to school and they have part-time jobs. And so seeking full-time work is not really an option for them unless they abandon some of those other responsibilities or endeavors they've taken. So, you know, it is just a policy choice as to how the legislature wants to fund that. Businesses are paying in for their part-time workers, but the rules require that they seek full-time work if they're going to draw their benefits currently.
Yes, Senator Pruzanski.
Madam Chair, just following up on that. So under current practices, employers are paying unemployment benefits even for part-time individuals. Those individuals who are serving or working aren't able to seek unless they're out there seeking full-time employment.
Correct.
Second, how many other states, if you know, actually provide this type of benefit for that type of work part-time?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, there's 20.
Would it be roughly the 20 that we have in this other data?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, not necessarily.
Okay.
And I think actually we do, I believe, in one of the future witnesses perhaps have a list, because I saw a footnote that listed all the states that have both provisions. So I think we'll be able to look that up.
I saw it there.
And Senator George, I believe, had a question, and then Vice Chair Telfer.
I guess my question is that it seems like to me that unemployment insurance was set up to supplement the income of the primary breadwinner in a family. So full-time, I'm sure that's why it was designed to exclude part-time employees. So I guess what I would be really curious about is that if you had a spouse who was simply part-time to add additional income, discretionary income to the family, and they lost their job, you wouldn't necessarily view that as something that unemployment insurance should cover. And that's why the system was set up the way it was. So we're making a policy decision to change that. So I guess my question to you would be, what percentage of these part-time employees are actually the primary breadwinner in the family? And would there be any way to calculate that or find that number out?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I don't know that there's a way we could find that out. We do know from statistics of Bureau of Labor and Industries, as in our written testimony, that 26% of the Oregon's workforce is part-time. Of those that would be the major breadwinner, I'm not sure we'd be able to, pardon me, discern. We may be able to go back to some census data and see if that captured that information, but we don't normally ask that in surveys.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess the point is that, I mean, at some point, we're talking, in many families, part-time workers are the discretionary income, and if we're going to put a heavy tax on our trust fund, which is supposed to take care of the primary breadwinner in the family, you're putting a pretty heavy burden on the infrastructure to deal with what, in I'm guessing in many families, would be a discretionary income. You know, and I'm trying to reconcile that in my mind, how that's a good policy decision. I'd understand if we're just dealing with primary breadwinners, and I guess if I could get that information, it'd be very helpful.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, we'll do our best to try to get that information. I hope this doesn't sound argumentative, but really we are presenting that policy question just to be resolved. So we're going to remain neutral and not offer an opinion, but we'll get all the data we can for you.
Madam Chair, I think, Senator George, just to comment a little bit, I think that what we see in the workforce today, though, is different. You're talking about when this originally was set up, and I don't know the history, if it was really targeted in 1935 to primary versus secondary, but the reality in today's world is most families have both people working, some full-time and some full-time and part-time, in order to make ends meet. And the nature of society and the nature of work has changed considerably over that time period. So many people have two part-time jobs sometimes to work around schedules and things. And so it is sort of a different time, and considering how we're covering those people, I think is a different policy question than it was in the past.
And I guess, Madam Chair, if I could, first of all, you're not argumentative, you're direct, and I appreciate it. So, to sort of respond, I guess that's why I would need the data to kind of make that determination. I think anecdotally the times have changed, but practically have they changed? Meaning, what are these part-time workers, and what is their role in their family, I think would be really key in this policy decision. So thank you very much.
And just to comment, and then I'll go to Senator Telfer, I think there are a lot of assumptions embedded in your question, which include that families include two people. They don't necessarily.
Absolutely.
They often include children and single people of either gender who are supporting them sometimes on these part-time wages. So.
Absolutely. So yeah. That's why information would be great on that.
Senator Telfer, please.
Well, my question I had 30 seconds ago has now changed because some of it's been answered. Lori's responses were pretty much what I was getting at with my question. Therefore, given the fact that most of my question has been answered, I'll ask a different one. As you're going through gathering this data, modernizing the system with Senate Bill 362, if in that process you might come up with other things that we need to modernize, obviously we have a different society where part-time job isn't necessarily supplemental and discretionary. So if there are other things that we need to modernize our system from 1937, is that what
Five.
It was?
Mm-hmm.
35?
No, 37.
Even worse. Even worse.
No, 35 is when it first.
We probably should be looking at those things. It's been a long time, and I don't think Oregon likes to operate in the dark ages. So if you come up with other or have some intent on going through that and looking at other areas that we may need to be modernizing the system for.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Telfer, we'd love to do that, and we often kick around what we should be doing differently. The world has changed in 70-plus years of unemployment insurance, and unfortunately, we don't get a lot of attention in our little world until we're in economic times like this, mm-hmm. and then we're under the microscope. So maybe when we have a little downturn, we can make it better.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much
for your
testimony. And next, I will call, I guess in the order that they signed up, Joy Markheim. And Sybil Hepp.
Members of the committee, Chair Rosenbaum, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, again, wanting to go on the record in support of Senate Bill 463. Wanted to follow up on, I think, some of the comments that you were making, Senator George and Representative. We at the Oregon Law Center see a number of families who are low income and struggling with part-time employment, which very well either may be the only source of employment in the family or may be supplemental income that's virtually necessary in order to continue to make the rent payments. And I think a lot of what that has to do with is child care obligations. Oftentimes, we know with the rising cost of child care, it's unaffordable to pay for full-time child care, especially for young children. You may be able to swing it with the help of neighbors or friends or with your partner if you have off hours to be able to provide child care in the home if you've got a part-time job, but you simply can't do that with a full-time schedule. So that's one thing. Also, lots of times we have single parents at home also caring for elderly family members, and so, you know, part-time is the only time they're available really to get out of the house and bring the money in. And so we appreciate the consideration of that population of folks when looking at unemployment security benefits, because for those people, really, the ability to have something to rely on if you lose that job out from under you may be very much the difference between being able to make the rent payment that month. So we appreciate your consideration.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, again, I'm Joy Markheim from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and thank you for letting me speak to you. I'm also here to support SB 463, And as I mentioned in my previous testimony, the unemployment insurance system does exclude many low-wage workers, and part-time workers and women are particularly affected. And this is because the unemployment insurance system hasn't adapted to these substantial changes that have occurred in the workforce in recent decades. And has also been mentioned, part-time workers, employers do pay into the system on their behalf, just as they do for other workers, even though these workers aren't able to collect those benefits as easily. So SB 463 would acknowledge the important role of part-time workers in today's workforce by eliminating this requirement that they look for full-time work in order to collect benefits. Today, as the Unemployment Department staff explained, one in four Oregon workers labors part-time, and for many of these workers, full-time work isn't a feasible option. They may, for example, be juggling work with caretaking responsibilities. But these workers do make significant contributions to household income, and this may speak a little bit to some of the questions you've had. One figure shows that nationally, and in households with a part-time worker, that worker contributes about a quarter, 24.1%, to the household income on average. That is a broad national average, so I'd like to explain that that means that there could be a lot of variation in there. That could mean that there are families who are getting where that worker is contributing substantially more. But it does indicate that employment unemployment benefits could play an important role in stabilizing families' finances when a part-time worker gets laid off. And there's also, it can be thought of as a financial incentive to implement SB 463 in that there are these federal funds available. If Oregon implements the alternative base period, the federal funds provided in the stimulus bill can help to cover the costs of implementing this bill as well. And in addition, this bill is good public policy. It recognizes these changes in the workforce, and in doing so, it reinforces the central goals of the unemployment insurance system. Unemployment insurance, as I think you're hearing from the testimony today, it's good for workers, it's good for businesses, and it's good for employers. Those temporary wage benefits help keep a family afloat when a worker gets laid off. And local merchants are better off when that family is able to keep spending on food and housing and basic goods. And once business conditions do turn around, it helps employers be able to call back the experienced workers they need. So by offering these partial wage replacements to thousands of additional workers each year, SB 463 would not only help shore up family finances, but also helps to stabilize the economy. And thank you again for letting me speak today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And we have Steve Lanning and J.L. Wilson. Please come forward. And I can't say gentleman first in this case without offending one of you, so...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're supportive of Senate Bill 463 because of the changing nature of work and it being a fairness issue as well, but we want to acknowledge that we are sensitive to the drawdown of the UI Trust Fund. You draw the fund down and business taxes kick in and go up to fill in the fund. So we are sensitive to that. We're always sensitive to that. It's usually the big issue. I probably ask more questions to some of the Employment Department folks that I talk with about the fund rather than a fairness issue with part-time workers. I mean, I think it was made real clear that employers that have part-time workers are paying into the fund already, and work has changed, and it's a fairness thing. So thank you.
Thank you. And please go ahead, JL.
Yes, thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members. For the record, JL Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. I think our general position is if you do pass a bill, we'd prefer you pass 462. Our difficulty with 463 and our caution is the ongoing liability for employers as you seek to get the $90 million in federal money. As the department said, 462 is 34 FTE on an ongoing basis, $8 million a year. Those numbers for 463 are somewhere in the neighborhood of $24 million of biennium for the upcoming biennium, $34 million for 2011-2013. We didn't establish the FTE for this, but I'm sure it's comparable to 462. And we're also waiting in the wings is 461, where you're talking about additional 3,000 to 4,000 claimants with FTE and cost on top of that. That tends to plow through that $90 million rather quickly. In fact, the full scope of those three proposals would burn through that $90 million in 3 to 4 years, in which case it's a permanent ongoing cost that is not borne by the stimulus money. It is ongoing, borne by employers. And that is our caution to you as you contemplate these proposals.
Okay. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 463?
Madam Chair.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Make comments afterwards.
Yeah. Sure.
Did
you want to hold your thoughts? Or?
Yeah, because it's actually to, I think, Tom.
For the department.
Yeah,
we'll have
department.
Them come back up after we hear from Ms. Martin.
Okay, thank you. So I just wanted to clarify something a little bit. After
you identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Christina Martin from Cascade Policy Institute. Thank you, Madam Chairman and Senators. So when the stimulus money runs out, we're going to have to ask where the money will come from and to support this particular bill. And I think that it's very important that we look at that issue now if you're going to pass this bill. To be clear, I said earlier that unemployment insurance actually increases unemployment. So I'm going to explain that just a little bit so that perhaps you will look into a solution for this issue. Okay, so unemployment insurance increases unemployment for two reasons. One, studies have shown, and this is pretty much conclusively established in labor economics, that unemployed workers who are covered by unemployment insurance actually stay unemployed much longer than, actually more than twice as long than those workers who are not covered. That's for obvious reasons. And then they've also shown that employers are actually more inclined to lay off workers when they have unemployment insurance to draw upon. Now, this is kind of a more difficult concept, but certain kinds of industries have consistently used unemployment insurance to actually subsidize their labor, and so it actually increases the overall unemployment rate because there's a motivation to lay off workers and to not change how they do business. So I would encourage the committee to look into a solution and perhaps get a task force to look for the next couple of years to see ways to perhaps tweak this system so that it so that we don't have to pay more in taxes, and you know, workers are ultimately the ones who pay for this, and two, so that maybe we can find an innovative solution, because there's a number out there, and around the world they're doing different kinds of unemployment systems that I think could really benefit Oregon.
So thank you for your testimony. I think you're essentially repeating what you said when you were up here before, and so I'll just remind you that you were asked to provide copies for the committee and
yes.
The administrator of these studies that you're citing. And I just would ask you, I mean, I've heard this argument for many years that having an unemployment insurance system encourages people to just not work, and it's really a very sort of difficult debate to have
in good times, but right now, you know, when we know that there are literally hundreds of applicants for every job that opens up, and when every time we open the newspaper, we're reading about more massive layoffs at some of the strongest companies, you know, that have existed in our state forever, it seems a little hard to be making the case that having a system that just provides benefits to people that are capped is really what's driving all of these great Oregon companies to just lay off their workers. So is that really what you think is happening?
That's not the only cause, obviously, but it has been shown that even in the depths of, actually in the depths of recession, it's been shown to especially have an effect on the unemployment rate. Now, obviously, there's a recession here, and so not all unemployment is caused by the existence of unemployment insurance. And I'm not suggesting that we don't have some kind of safety net, but I do know there are a lot of ways to change the system. There's innovative solutions. This is a pretty old way of doing unemployment insurance.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any additional questions? Okay.
Comment.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Comments?
Ms. Martin, please. I guess when you're putting this together, it sounds like you've read some different innovative ways of doing it. That would be something that I would be interested in. I think the committee would be as to what has been tried, what has been tested, and it's shown to be true or a better way to provide this type of a service. And then, Madam Chair, just some other comments. Here, I'm going to send George's back because anecdotally or whatever it may be, I know from my discussions with people in my district, there are many individuals that are two-member households of parents or partners that are working, and they find for themselves they actually have to have multiple jobs to make ends meet because of the burdens they have for the cost of living, for rent, house payments, child care, and as well as also the scheduling of being able to provide that, as to the alternative of having the ability to have child care provided. And I think this is one of those issues that we as a society need to have some flexibility, knowing how at least the upbringing I had, we had kind of what I call the leave it to Beaver family, where my father was the single income coming into the house, with the exception when we needed to pay bills that couldn't get paid besides my mother working, or if we're getting ready for a vacation requiring that to actually occur. But today it doesn't seem to be that way to me, and I think with the comments from the agency as to what might have been perceived in 37 and through the decades since there has definitely changed. And to me, I'm looking for innovative ways that we can make certain that we have people working. And then the other part is that I don't think that we as a society, hopefully in Oregon, want to make a decision that says that a parents can't have some type of lifestyle that allows one of those parents to be home with their kids for some period of time during the day and then have to work to still make ends meet, as compared to having some daycare if they choose to actually have that influence on their families.
Thank you. And Christina, I don't think you need to comment on that unless you really...
I was going to ask you if you would like me to comment or if you'd just like me to submit maybe a summary of studies.
Yes, would that'd be great.
I think that would be super.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks again.
And do I give that to the administrator or
Yeah, we'll get you the contact
you.
Information. And it looks like we have questions, more questions for the department, so please come forward.
And Madam Chair, while they're coming up, Joy, who's with OCPP, in the packet I received, there's a fact sheet for Senate Bill 461, and if there's supposed to be, and there wasn't one for 463, if there's supposed to be one, I just want to make sure she submits for all of us whatever she wanted. Yeah, and I don't know if the other packets were this way or not.
I didn't get them all.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Two were combined on one.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think I observed the same thing. I saw a fact sheet for a bill we're not hearing today, but I did not see the fact sheet for this bill.
And I'll give this to our committee administrators.
Right, and we'll get copies to the members.
Sure.
Okay, so welcome back. We're getting to know you very well.
So, Senator Manas Anderson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. When you came to talk to me in my office before, I felt that you described a system that has worked very, very well, and the rules that you have, or the criteria that you have for people to become eligible for unemployment is pretty good, because you need to have proof, so to speak, that you have worked. But could you go and describe a little bit about the average tax rate for the UI tax schedules? And you gave us a great graph, and I think that that should be on the record, because in times of hard times, that tax rate goes up. And it seems like it's actually harder on businesses when it does go up, and then in good times it goes way down. It's too bad it's not reversed, where we tax them less during periods of recession. But I think for public record, that you should put that on the record for public hearing.
So if I understand your question, I think what you're getting at is an explanation of how our system works, which is actually fairly unique, I think, in the country, of having a self-balancing mm-hmm. system for rates. So if you could go ahead and offer that explanation.
And I think you also stated that there are other states that are in dire straits, and especially when you take a look at California. So I feel we're very unique, and that we're in a sense progressive. But I need you to explain that a little bit.
Madam Chair, Senator Manas Anderson, the Oregon system was established in 1975, and in statutes, there are 8 tax schedules, and I think we do have handouts. Is there enough copies that we maybe should give you?
There are
indeed. Some of you we were able to catch and find a few minutes with to go through this, because it is the underpinnings for the Oregon system. And it is the reason that Oregon is solvent today in terms of its trust fund and what is being paid in benefits out to UI recipients. So the 8 tax schedules, the Oregon middle tax schedule, tax schedule 4, businesses pay in as much taxes as what we are paying out in benefits, is called equilibrium. We are currently in tax schedule 3, which is below that. The tax rate is calculated for businesses in September of every year, and then they are paying that rate beginning in January. So we move up and down this tax schedule based on the reserves that are in the fund in September when we calculate it, and there has to be enough reserves in the fund to pay for the recessionary time period, and that language is described in statute, so that it is always self-correcting. And what you might notice about this chart is that on the far right-hand side, the tax schedule 8, which is the highest tax schedule that we have, after the 80s recession, which some people were here when they had the 80, we had the 80 recession, you remember that. You will see that for 7 years in a row, businesses were in that tax schedule as the trust fund was rebuilt. And then in the latter part, if you look back down to tax schedule 3, which is the other most frequent one, we've been in that tax schedule at various times where you have a lower tax rate for businesses. So it just moves up and down automatically so that we retain solvency in the fund. And Oregon is one of a few states across the country that has this in place that's like this. And that's a credit to the people in the 70s, who determined this is how we were going to operate in the state. The other states, Tom will point out if he were speaking, we tax the first, this tax rate applies to the first $31,300 for 2000 of earnings for 2009, and it's indexed. Some states have much lower wages that they apply the tax to. I believe California's $7,000. So some of their problem lies in what their tax base is, but these are policy questions that the legislative body here grappled with and determined that we would have basically a solvent system. So it is designed to withstand recessions, and it moves back and forth, and it's the basis. So when we talk about the testimony here, we have $90 million in incentive money that's available to Oregon, and it would come into this trust fund and become part of the balance in the trust fund. And we would pay out benefits based on the changes that you approve, and how long the $90 million will last will be dependent on how many of these bills you choose to support. But the tax schedules will go up and down whether we do anything about the $90 million or not. And we calculated, I want folks to know, we calculated the tax rate we're in right now, Tax Schedule 3, in September of last year. So if you think back to September of last year, we were just beginning this downturn. And so when we come to calculations in September of 2009, the trust fund's going to be in a different position than it was in September of 2008. So with that, unless Tom has other comments, we're happy to take questions about this.
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Follow up, Lori, a little bit. Usually this is like a carrot and a stick, you know, carrot being $90 million.
Yeah. Yes.
And the carrot will be eaten and gone, and the more bills we adopt here, the faster. Excuse me. So obviously that means that we're going to be in the far right zone 8, so to speak, when that runs out. Because we're going to have to replenish it, self-balance, and we no longer have the 90. My question is going to be, though, well, it's kind of a dual question, meaning if the $90 million wasn't being waived in front of us, would we be having these discussions today? And then the second part of that question is, or doesn't it make a difference? Because we're self-balancing, meaning there's going to be a number of years where we've got a lot of money in the fund, therefore we're going to be paying lower rates. When the money's gone, we're going to be paying the higher rates. Is this just delaying that, and we're going to do that anyway because of the high draw on unemployment trust funds that we're going to incur probably in the next 4 years?
Madam Chair, Senator Toffler, your question is a good one, because if you set aside the $90 million and you just look at these tax schedules and what happens during recessions, before and after recessions, you're moving up those tax schedules as you're recovering from recessions because you have to replenish what you've paid out in benefits. And that's going to happen. And we can't tell you exactly which one of these tax schedules that's going to mean in September of 2009, because right now we're still paying out benefits and employers are still paying in, and it's that net difference between those two that's going to drive us either to tax schedule 4, 5, or 6, or 8. But that's going to happen. The $90 million will go in here, and initially, if the $90 million comes in, for example, in July of this year, it's going to add to this base, and it may help prevent us from going up a tax schedule as soon as we may. It may mitigate that, but eventually, as it pays out, along with the other benefits, you're going to kick up into other tax schedules.
Follow-up question?
Go ahead.
Without the $90 million, would we still, because we're going to have a large draw probably, unfortunately, on the trust funds, will we also see this large increase even without the $90 million? It may take longer, but we're still going to see large increases to replenish the funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfair, it's hard for us. There will be, of course, increases. The question is, how big will the jump be from tax schedule 3 to which next tax schedule? How big will that be? And that's the unknown for us right now.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Przanski.
So I think I'm tracking as to how this works, in the sense of we have a set amount that we want to maintain in the account. And so every year you look at it based on what the forecasts are, how much has been paid out, what the drawdown's been, what has been paid back in, and then figure out whatever is remaining to get us back to that number. What is the number, first of all, that we're trying to maintain?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, there's not an exact number. What we are trying to maintain, though, is enough reserves to pay 18 months of benefits at the worst economic time in the last 10 years. That's what the U.S. Department of Labor calls solvent.
Okay.
There are seven states or eight states, I believe, that actually meet that formula of being solvent, and we're one of those states. So that's the goal. And, in fact, in the 2005 legislative session, we looked at these eight tax rate schedules because we wanted to determine, well, how solvent is solvent, and were we really hitting the mark? Well, we were a little bit high, and so we smoothed out the jump between six schedules two and three. There was a little bit bigger jump, so we lowered that, and it's a little bit more of a smooth progression. And we actually saved $94 million in taxes for employers back then. So that's what we've done. We keep looking at it, and so there's no set number, but we're looking at 18 months of benefits.
All right, and following up.
Yes, go ahead.
So understanding that, then basically at this point, we're not sure because the uncertainty of how much we're going to be paying out, but the reality, if we took this $90 million, it's going to give us such an infusion that it should buffer to some level unless the bond just totally falls out, and we would see less of an increase from a Schedule 3 up the line, maybe the first time, realizing that once we start paying this out and it drops it back down to stay solvent, then we may see a larger jump because the proportionality is out. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but we want to make sure that it's understood that one bill, 462 and $90 million, it could have a nice buffer, but as we stack other packages on, there may be a difference. And we've been really striving to make sure that's clear.
I mean, the bottom line is what you're letting us know as a policymaker is that if we continue to draw on this account, it's going to have more of an impact as if we were just clean, took 462 alone. That's something that's the variables are less in number as compared to having 463, possibly what 461 may provide to us.
Correct. Go ahead, Senator Minus Anderson.
It just makes sense to me, my gut level says, to have bills like this during times, really tough times, when there are so many people going on the rolls. When bills like this come forward, though, then this will go on forever. And we pass so many bills that have sunset dates. Have you ever considered having sunsets on this until we get out of the recession, or just doesn't that make good sense to you?
Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, it's a great question, and a little bit of background. This is a federal-state partnership for unemployment insurance. Every state in the union, in fact, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and Washington, D.C., are all part of this compact, if you will. And there are certain laws we have to follow under federal guidelines, and then there are state choices. And one of those state choices is you can allow people to draw benefits while they're working part-time. That's just the state choice that we've offered up in our testimony. Back to the conformity problem, however, this incentive money, this $90 million, did come with a sort of a string. And that is that when you put it in, you can't have a sunset on it. And that's a federal conforming issue.
Okay.
That's not to say that in other matters a sunset would be a good idea, but in this particular one, a sunset would not allow us to get the $90 million incentive.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I think this has been a great discussion, but it is the case that I think there have been proposals both at a state level and in Congress for a very long time to get more states to adopt Senate Bill 462, because it is really sort of updating a payroll system and a system of calculating benefits that once you go forward in that sense, it doesn't make sense to go backward, because it's basically just saying in that bill that people will get credit for the wages that they have earned for the full year prior to when they become unemployed through no fault of their own. So I think it really, when you think about it, it's a sensible thing that the federal government is saying, we're only going to give you this money if you do adopt this technology and this provision. So
just my opinion. Yes, Senator Pozanski.
So basically, 462, it's understood under the compact. We, if we adopt it, then we're going to stick with it. Now, there's nothing I would say maybe in 10 years from now, if we chose to rethink that or look at it, there's nothing that says that we would have to pay back that $90 million, is there?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, no, you're absolutely right. That's, of course, unless the federal government made it a conforming law.
That's
regulation.
Correct. But you're right. But at the same time, if we wanted to have a little bit more control over these other bills, we could sunset them if we chose to do so without jeopardizing our buy-in on, under 462.
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions for the department? Thank you very much all of this information. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 463. And members, it would be our intention to get the fiscal. So that means that we need to post these bills for work session in order to do that. And so as soon as we get that fiscal information, we will distribute it to you, as well as some of the other written information that was alluded to but not provided today. So with nothing further to come before us, I will adjourn the committee. Thank you.